Saudi courts handed down a death sentence to an academic for using social media platforms as the kingdom intensifies its crackdown on dissent. The NATO chief says Ukraine can expect more Western heavy weapons soon, despite Russia's warnings that the move will only prolong the war. And thousands of health workers march in Madrid demanding the government stop dismantling public health services in favor of the private sector. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, a Saudi academic is now on death row for using social media as the Arab monarchy is tightening its grip on dissidents. A prominent pro-reform law professor, Awad al-Qarni, was arrested back in September 2017 as part of a campaign of arrests that included at least 20 people. His alleged charges include owning a Twitter account and using WhatsApp to spread messages deemed hostile to the kingdom. Human rights advocates warning that the regime is engaged in a new crackdown on free thinkers. That's while the Saudi government and state-controlled investors are raising their financial stakes in U.S. platforms like Twitter and Facebook. The use of social media has been criminalized within the country since the beginning of Mohammed bin Salman's reign. Iran is seeing a record rise in oil exports as the government's ramped up initiatives to nullify U.S. sanctions. According to companies that track the flows, Iranian oil exports hit new highs in the last 2 months of 2022 and are also making strong strides this year. Companies put the crude exports back in November at 1.2 million barrels a day, highest since August. China is Iran's biggest customer. The former U.S. administration has sought to completely wipe out Iran's oil exports by withdrawing from the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA and reimposing sanctions against the country. The current U.S. administration also says it is robustly enforcing the sanctions and has even imposed new bans. Iran has recently reported an almost 20% year-on-year increase in its non-oil exports. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has condemned as a heinous execution the Israeli killing of a man in the occupied West Bank. The ministry says Israeli leadership has made it easy for regime forces to kill Palestinians even if they pose no danger. Earlier in the day, Israeli forces shot dead 45-year-old Ahmed Kala in front of his son near the village of Selwad, north of Ramallah. The Israeli army claimed he was killed while attempting to grab a soldier's gun and resisting inspection. Palestinian media, however, reported soldiers forced Kala out of his vehicle before shooting him at point-blank range. The man's son was also pepper-sprayed. Tensions have been simmering in the West Bank, with Israeli forces intensifying deadly raids across the occupied territories. At least 13 Palestinians have been killed since the beginning of the year, and last year's death toll of around 150 was the highest since 2004. Israeli President Isaac Herzog has expressed deep concern over the growing protests held against the policies of the newly elected right-wing cabinet.
We are in the grips of a profound disagreement that is tearing our nation apart. This conflict worries me deeply, as it worries many across Israel and the diaspora.
Herzog said he is currently focused on averting a historic constitutional crisis and stopping the continued rift within the nation. Tens of thousands of protesters hit the streets of Tel Aviv last night, chanting slogans against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The demonstration was the biggest since Netanyahu's cabinet took office in late December. Now he returned to power at the head of a coalition with extreme right and ultra-Orthodox parties. Cabinet is planning to hand more powers to lawmakers in appointing judges and overriding the regime's Supreme Court decisions. It's also announced intentions to pursue settlement expansion in the occupied West Bank. The Western military alliance NATO has hinted about providing more heavy weapons to Ukraine in the very near future. The NATO Secretary General said new military aid is expected to follow Kiev's request to its allies for vehicles, artillery, and missiles. Jens Stoltenberg was quoted as saying, ahead of a meeting this week of a group that coordinates arms supplies to Kiev, on Saturday the UK also pledged to supply main battle tanks to Ukraine. Russia has time and again warned Western governments against their policies. Recently, a top Russian security official said events in Ukraine are not a clash between Moscow and Kiev, but a military confrontation between Russia and NATO. The West, the U.S. in particular, have provided Kiev with billions of dollars of arms and military equipment since the start of the war last year. And Belarus has also announced joint military drills with Russia, saying maneuvers started from Monday will be defensive in nature starting from Monday. Now, the country's Security Council says two-week-long drills will focus on aerial reconnaissance missions and how to thwart a potential attack. Separately, the Defense Ministry has been quoted as saying situation on the country's southern border remains tense. It says the Belarusian forces are maintaining restraint and patience, but will be ready to deal with any provocation from Ukraine. A flurry of military activities in Belarus has triggered fears in Kiev and its Western backers that Russia could use its ally to launch a new ground offensive against Ukraine. Belarus became increasingly aligned with Russia after breaking away from the erstwhile Soviet Union in the 1990s. Thousands of health workers have marched on Madrid streets protesting privatizing the public health system. Protesters demand the conservative regional government stop dismantling public health services in favor of the private sector. The Madrid municipal administration is led by the Popular Party, which has come under fire in recent years. Ralliers in central Madrid accuse regional authorities of poor staffing in hospitals and healthcare centers during the COVID pandemic. Now, leader of the Conservative Party has responded by blaming left-wing parties as the main orchestrators of the strikes to win the upcoming election. The British government is set to put forth new proposals to quell public protests by giving police more powers to prevent serious disruption. Now, the government passed legislation to address the issue last year, but it is planning to go further with a new set of laws known as the Public Order Bill, which is being debated in Parliament. The government wants to amend the bill before it becomes law, and that in order to broaden the power of police to deal with demonstrators who block traffic or lock themselves to objects or buildings. Protesters in recent years have caused inconvenience in many cities, prompting calls for the police to intervene. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has defended the new proposal, saying that protests by a small minority should not affect other citizens. Civil rights groups, however, warned the legislation will be against democracy if passed by Parliament. And earlier in our news review program, we discussed the strikes in the UK that have been ongoing since summer. Here's a replay of the program.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The UK is bracing for fresh nationwide strikes as workers from various sectors are demanding higher wages amid a cost of living crisis. The Royal College of Nursing Union has warned of more walkouts next month if talks with the government do not progress by the end of January. The union says that it will be more severe, involving twice as many workers. Meanwhile, teachers will hold a ballot on Monday over industrial actions. If their strikes are confirmed, it will add to the disruption experienced in the country over the last 6 months. Ambulance staff and rail workers are among those staging back-to-back walkouts as pay rises have failed to keep pace with the double-digit inflation. Earlier this week, the UK government introduced an anti-strike bill to Parliament that requires some union members to work even during strikes. Syed Purizar is our correspondent joining us from London. We also have Steve Keen, who's an economist and author, joining us from Amsterdam. Welcome to you both. Syed Purizar, so give us a wrap-up about these strikes in terms of what we're looking at, the various sectors, and when they will be happening.
More strikes are planned, Kaveh, for the coming weeks and month. No doubt, starting with what you just read, the RCN, the Royal College of London, saying they will be planning a much bigger one in February. I understand it's going to be on February 6th to correspond with a survey that came out 10 years ago on the impact of nurse shortages on patient mortality. Earlier, we heard from the RCN General Secretary Pat Cullen that they would agree after the government gave them some kind of optimism that a deal was reachable, within reach, that they would agree to 10% pay rise compared to the 19% that they have been asking for. That didn't happen, as we saw on Monday last week, when those negotiations between the government and the unions fell through 45 minutes into the meeting, followed by that bill that requires six industries to have their workers work or provide minimum service on strike days or face losing their jobs, that has had all the different unions up in arms. So that's the RCN. Of course, Wednesday, 55 NHS trusts that were not part of the previous round of NHS strikes will be walking out. You're looking at tens of thousands of people walking out of their jobs, followed by railway workers, as well as you said, teachers will be balloting tomorrow, their union saying that if they don't vote for a strike action to give them the mandate to do so, they will ask their members to vote again so that they can go on strike. Then you have ASLEF, the train drivers union, who have been saying that the government has offered them 8%, that their general secretary, Mick Whelan, saying that he didn't see one line in the government's offer that he supported. And that tells you how determined these unions are to continue with their industrial action in the days, weeks, and months ahead. And as they said last week, that they are in it for the long haul, to borrow a term from the transportation industry. And so they're very determined. The government is also being recalcitrant, as all the different unions have been saying. But there seems to be some kind of optimism as far as the RMT and the TSSA, the RMT, the Railway Maritime and Transport Union, that they might come to some kind of a deal with the rail employers. But we'll have to see. You can't really put a definitive timeline or timetable on any of this unless and until they come out with an agreement. We're going to see those negotiations resume this week, and the outcome of that we will have to wait and see. But if they don't, then, as I say, we're definitely going to see more strikes crippling the different industries in the coming days, weeks, and perhaps months, Kevin.
Well, Steve Keen, when we take a look at this, obviously there's got to be the talks, and whether they're going to reach an agreement or not remains to be seen. Your thoughts on that? But overall, then the question comes about whatever agreement that is reached, if there is going to be any agreements, is where the money's going to come from.
Well, the money is created by the government. This is one of the most frustrating things about how people think about the government spending. The government is one of the two money creation systems in a modern economy. Banks create money by lending out more than they get back in repayments. Governments create money by running a deficit, spending more than they get back in taxes. They can simply decide to create the money. And they do not borrow from the public. They do not borrow from the banks. They sell banks, bonds, in return for reserves, which are also created by the deficit. So the government is hamstringing itself by its own lack of understanding of how money is actually created.
Doesn't that mean that if they do that, that would maybe contribute to inflation or no?
Well, inflation has happened without them doing it. So let's just get that started. First of all, it's other factors which have contributed to the inflation, partially the increasing cost of energy and the lengthening supply chains. And also, when there was a large amount of government money creation during COVID, that took the pressure off manufacturers and enabled them to put larger markups in there. But a large part of the costs that England is bearing are coming out of the fact that it's let its manufacturing sector run down. And if there's a fall in the currency, then it pays that way as well. So this is a whole cacophony of failures by the government. First of all, understand what it does, and then doing the wrong thing anyway.
Why is it that we keep hearing about the fact that the era of money printing is over, that the 0% interest is now finished, and that is one of the reasons why we're seeing what we're seeing in part in the various countries, that they're suffering economically overall?
Well, partially. None of the governments have actually understood how money is created, and the economics profession actually makes that worse by peddling myths and giving people like Ben Bernanke a Nobel Prize for peddling myths about banks themselves not creating money. So it's a huge mishmash of failures. But there are fundamental factors as well, and a large part of this is we're depleting our energy reserves, and energy becoming prices are becoming more volatile, energy availability less secure. So it isn't just the past failures; it's also the fact that we're pushing pushing past the boundaries of the planet, and a lot of the costs that are coming back our way are due to the breakdown of the climate, then affecting the capacity of the economy to produce.
Okay. Thank you so much for that, Saeed Pourreza, our correspondent there talking to us from London, and Steve Keen, a pleasure, economist and author from Amsterdam. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review.
In the United Kingdom, a man's been arrested as part of a counterterrorism probe after traces of uranium were found in a cargo package at London's Heathrow Airport. Police say the man in his 60s was detained on Saturday in northwest England and later released on bail until April. They say the incident does not appear to be linked to any direct threat to the public. According to British media, though, the package was found on December 29th and it had originated from Pakistan on a flight from Oman. Investigations are still underway. Uranium can be used for civilian power generation and scientific purposes and is a key ingredient in nuclear weapons. Certain isotopes emit radiation that can be harmful to humans, and the metal itself is toxic if ingested or inhaled. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Aides to U.S. President Joe Biden have discovered at least one more batch of classified documents in a location separate from a think tank office he used after serving as vice president. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website MSN.com has covered this story and tells us more. President Joe Biden's legal team found additional classified documents when they searched a second location after finding secret government papers in a different Biden office in early November, according to a person familiar with the investigation. Earlier this week, an attorney for Joe Biden said the president's personal lawyers had discovered a small number of classified documents at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement, an institute in downtown Washington that Joe Biden started after serving as vice president. People familiar with the matter said that that discovery involved about 10 classified documents. Biden's lawyers notified government agencies and the Justice Department opened an investigation to see how the classified material got there and whether there was any other material that should be under government lock and key. Legal representatives for the president found additional classified material at a second location, a person said on Wednesday, 11th of January, speaking on condition of anonymity. The person would not say when the material was found. The second batch of classified material was first reported by NBC News. Spokesmen for the Justice Department, the FBI, and the White House declined to comment. Earlier, a White House spokeswoman refused to say if any additional classified material had been found beyond the batch at the Penn Biden Center. This is under review by the Department of Justice. I'm not going to go beyond what the president shared, White House spokeswoman Karine Jean-Pierre said, declining to respond to several questions about whether additional properties, including Joe Biden's Delaware homes in Wilmington and Rehoboth Beach, had been searched. White House officials have said that they are cooperating with the Justice Department and that Joe Biden's lawyers quickly handed over the documents to the National Archives and Records Administration, the agency tasked with handling of presidential records. A Biden lawyer said the classified documents at the Penn Biden Center were found on 2nd of November, when one of his personal attorneys opened a locked closet to pack up the contents. The White House counsel's office notified the National Archives, which took possession of the documents the following day, a Biden lawyer confirmed. That discovery came not long before Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed a special counsel, Jack Smith, to oversee the agency's criminal investigation into former President Donald Trump's possible mishandling of hundreds of classified documents that were taken to Mar-a-Lago after his presidency ended. Officials have said the investigation of Trump concerns not just the possible mishandling of government secrets, but also possible obstruction of justice or destruction of presidential records. To review the discovery of Biden's classified documents, Merrick Garland tapped U.S. Attorney John Loesch of Chicago, a holdover from the Trump administration. Depending on what his initial investigation yields, Merrick Garland could decide to appoint a special counsel. While the Biden case has obvious echoes of the Mar-a-Lago investigation into Donald Trump's conduct, the details provided by Joe Biden's lawyer on Monday suggested key differences that could factor heavily in whether the Biden documents became a criminal matter. Joe Biden's lawyer, Richard Sober, said the Biden documents were discovered by the president's lawyers and voluntarily turned over to the authorities. By comparison, in Donald Trump's case, the National Archives and Record Administration officials pressed for material to be handed over, and then Donald Trump's office was served with a grand jury subpoena demanding their return. After Trump's lawyers delivered 38 classified documents in response to the subpoena, an FBI search recovered more than 100 additional classified documents that were not turned over to the authorities. Much of the criminal investigation into the keeping of classified documents at Mar-a-Lago, Donald Trump's private club and residence, has centered on what officials have described in court papers as possible obstruction of efforts to recover all of the documents. So far, no such allegation has been leveled in the Biden matter, though it is at an earlier stage. Legal experts say it is not uncommon for some people who have security clearances to mishandle classified documents, but these situations are typically handled administratively and not criminally, because the criteria for prosecuting people who mishandled classified documents include proving the person deliberately flouted rules for how to secure the materials. NBC News has also covered this story. Aides to President Joe Biden have discovered at least one additional batch of classified documents in a location separate from the Washington office he used after leaving the Obama administration, according to a person familiar with the matter. Since November, after the discovery of documents with classified markings in his former office, Joe Biden aides have been searching for any additional classified materials that might be in other locations he used, said the source who spoke on condition of anonymity. The White House did not reply to a request for comment. The Justice Department had no comment to make. The initial discovery of classified documents in an office used by Joe Biden after his vice presidency was first reported on Monday, 9th of January, by CBS News. The classification level, number and precise location of the additional documents was not immediately clear. It also was not immediately clear when the additional documents were discovered and if the search of any other classified materials Biden may have from the Obama administration is complete. Joe Biden aides have been sifting through documents stored at locations beyond his former Washington office to determine if there are any other classified documents that need to be turned over to the National Archives and Record Administration and reviewed by the Justice Department, the person familiar with the matter has said. The search was described as exhaustive, with the goal of getting a full accounting of all classified documents that may have inadvertently been packed in boxes when Joe Biden cleared out of Vice President's office space in January of 2017. Senator Josh Hawley, a Republican senator from Missouri, reacted on social media just minutes after the NBC News report on the new documents, tweeting out the words special counsel. The White House on Monday, 9th of January, issued a statement confirming that a small number of documents with classified markings that appeared to be from the Obama administration had been found at a Washington think tank tied to Joe Biden. The documents were discovered in a locked closet by Biden's attorney while they prepared to vacate office space at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement. Richard Sober, special counsel to the president, said in a statement on Monday. The University of Pennsylvania had leased a suite of offices for the center in February of 2018, including one for then private citizen Joe Biden's personal use when he was in Washington. Biden told reporters on Tuesday, 10th of January, that he was surprised by the discovery and that he didn't know what was in the documents. The chair and vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee have written to Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, asking for access to the classified documents, a damage assessment by the intelligence community, and a briefing on both the Biden and the Trump documents, three congressional staffers confirmed. This request is similar to how the committee requested information after the raid at Mar-a-Lago, former President Donald Trump's resort in Florida.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us contemplate upon the words of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, regarding his blissful marital life with Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. By Allah, I never angered Fatima or forced her to do something that she did not like, up to the day she passed away. Nor did she ever anger or disobey me. In fact, when I looked at her, depression and sadness would vanish from my heart.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission.
This is IRIB English Radio.
This is the show A to Z. For today's program, Brother Muhammad is going to talk to us about Islamic education. Stay tuned.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's discussion with regards to Islamic education, we would like to look at some of the strategies that can be used in inculcating and nurturing Salah into the lives of our children. Our children are human beings, after all, and they are encouraged by the process of rewards and praise. And likewise, when they are faced with rewards, they not only are encouraged in performing an act, rather they're encouraged to actually continue performing that act repeatedly at different intervals and different stages and different instances. And this is an act that we find is part of the lifestyle of the Holy Prophet when it came to inculcating and nurturing Salah in the lives of his own companions. That we have a story that Rasulullah once was gifted two very healthy, stout camels by a person. And he looked towards his companions and he asked them, "Is there a person amongst you who can pray two rakats, two units of Salah, in a state that he is only... his only attention is towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and he has no connection and no attachment to the dunya or the affairs of this material world?" And nobody at that time stood up till the third time, when Rasulullah asked, Imam Ali alayhi salam stood up and he said, "I am ready for this, O Rasulullah." And Rasulullah allowed him, and he stood to pray two rakat salah with proper and complete presence of the heart, that Rasulullah at the end rewarded Imam Ali alayhi salam with one of those camels that he had received as a gift. And indeed, at that time, we're also told that Jibreel came down, he descended, and he communicated Allah's salams to Rasulullah. And he also conveyed to Rasulullah the endorsement of the fact that Imam Ali alayhi salam deserved one of those camels as well. So we find that the process of rewarding is an important part of nurturing Salah into the lives of our children. When adults such as the companions of the Prophet would get excited from the prospect of receiving a gift, the children themselves, their children are, after all, they would be more excited and they would be more enthusiastic about performing Salah properly if we were to have a reward process in place for them. And only through reward and encouragement we can progress and lead our children into worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and learning basically in learning how to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And as parents, we need to specifically use this as one of the major strategies when it comes to nurturing salah in the lives of our children. I hope you enjoy today's discussion. Until next time, fi amanillah, under God's protection.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
The chip, a tiny piece of technological equipment, was in its most basic form born with transistor radios. 60 years ago, when the chip industry was still nascent, a mere 4 transistors could fit on a chip. But today, as many as 11.8 billion can. Also known as a semiconductor, the chip is used to animate everything from toys to nuclear weapons. Sometimes described as the world's most critical technology, the chip is so crucial a feat that it has been the subject of a technological war between the United States and China for quite some time. Let's see how the war is unfolding in a nutshell.
In early October came the United States' biggest salvo against China in that war. U.S. President Joe Biden imposed export controls that would block China's access to advanced semiconductors. A day later, the local government of Shenzhen, China's technology hub, announced a plan to advance its semiconductors industry faster. And just days later, as the Chinese Communist Party's 20th National Congress concluded, the Chinese government designated the war over technology a threat of priority.
So far, semiconductor manufacturing companies in the U.S. have been making 30% of their revenue from sales to China. The country imported $400 billion worth of chips in 2021. To offset the consequences of U.S. restrictions in the technology field, China is said to be taking the whole-of-the-nation approach, mobilizing all national resources.
China invested as much as $11 billion in quantum computing between 2009 and 2011, compared with $3 billion by the United States. Government-led investment in semiconductors has seen $137 billion of funding for the industry. China's central bank has introduced special low-interest loans for high-tech firms, and hundreds of labs are being launched to enhance research.
By all appearances, the United States' tech war on China is inducing the country to do more on its own to gain the know-how. The war may set China's tech industry back a number of years, but if the Chinese muddle through and acquire the science through their own research, they will end up in a better position in several years than they would have been had their access to American chips been unhindered.
The sanctions have thrust into uncertainty the activities of some of China's supreme semiconductor manufacturers. Advanced Microfabrication Equipment Incorporation, or AMEC, is one such company, owned by semiconductor whiz Gerald Yen, who has earned a doctorate from the University of California and is an American citizen, who returned to China in 2004 to contribute to the tech industry of his homeland. The October sanctions also prohibit, quote, the services of American talent to China's semiconductors industry. Yen, while originally a Chinese, now faces hurdles as a U.S. citizen to continue to work at his own company in China. So do 6 other top managers at his firm, who are also U.S. citizens.
But in other important ways, China's by-the-bootstraps approach is already paying off.
The country's largest semiconductor manufacturer, the Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corporation, had started shipping 7-nanometer chips despite American sanctions. Yangtze Memory Technologies Corporation, the state-owned memory chip producer, was on track to supply parts to be used in Apple iPhones before the embargo. Last year, domestic revenues in China's semiconductor industry surpassed $157 billion, and 19 of the 20 fastest-growing semiconductor companies globally were Chinese. In his report to the Chinese Communist Party's 20th National Congress in October, days after President Biden announced the most sweeping restrictions on China in the chip industry, Chinese President Xi Jinping said China had to, quote, win the battle in core technologies. That President Xi made that appeal and that he used the word technology 40 times, up from 17 in the report from the 2017 Congress, are no coincidences. China is perfectly aware of not only the implications of the new American sanctions, but also of the critical need to achieve self-sufficiency in technological fields that, for all intents and purposes, will determine the course of history in the years to come.
Well, it's a war that the United States may have launched, but it doesn't look like that it's going to be the one that the United States gets to end. In September, as a lawsuit was proceeding against him in a federal court in the United States, Mohammed bin Salman abruptly became Saudi Arabia's prime minister, a role with sovereign rights that he hadn't enjoyed previously as of only the country's crown prince. That dubious move paid off on Thursday, November 17th, when the U.S. State Department said that bin Salman enjoyed head of state immunity in U.S. courts, effectively dooming the lawsuit filed against him for his role in the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Here's how bin Salman escaped punishment in a nutshell.
Khashoggi was a loyalist-turned-dissident who lived in self-exile in the United States and wrote articles critical of bin Salman in the Washington Post. In late 2018, he traveled to Turkey to obtain papers he needed to marry his Turkish fiancée from Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul. On October 2nd, he entered the diplomatic building. He never left, not on his own feet. A hit squad flown in from Saudi Arabia had been waiting for him inside the consulate. There, they tortured him to death and then dismembered his body, taking his limbs outside in suitcases. Khashoggi's fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, waited for hours outside for him to appear. When he didn't, she alerted Turkish police.
Soon, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, a personal friend of the would-have-been couple, joined the fray head over heels. Hardly a day went by without President Erdogan or the Turkish government commenting publicly on the case and thus directing international attention to the Saudi government or dropping hints that bin Salman, the crown prince, may have been personally involved.
Turkish security agencies even released audio tapes from inside the consulate with people yelling and Khashoggi screaming, effectively detailing the grisly murder and keeping the international community focused. And only a month and a half after the murder, the Washington Post, which had been Khashoggi's publication of choice, dropped a bombshell. The CIA had concluded that Mohammed bin Salman had personally ordered Khashoggi's murder. The CIA never spoke publicly about the reported finding.
Already the world had learned of an earlier princely gambit. Mohammed had become crown prince through what U.S. media termed as a coup, clearing the way of his rivals and holding the then crown prince in custody until he agreed to step down. To learn that the prince had now been so emboldened as to order the murder of his critics in foreign countries seemed to have been a step too far. And it seemed like the prince was going to be held to account.
There was reason to believe that way. President Erdogan was unrelenting in his public admonishments of Saudi Arabia. Years later, before and after he assumed office, U.S. President Joe Biden was openly critical of Saudi Arabia. At one point during a presidential debate, and when he was asked about the Khashoggi case, Biden said he would make the Saudis, quote, pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are.
All of that angry moral posturing went to the dustbin when the U.S. State Department said that the Saudi prince had legal immunity. Saudi King Salman, Mohammed's father, had already bent over backwards to make that possible, but even he himself couldn't have believed that the Americans would fall for his scheme that easily.
Legally, the prime minister himself, as king of the country, Salman acted against Saudi law by delegating that position to his son in late September, just as Khashoggi's fiancé was doing everything she could to have justice delivered at court. President Biden's rhetoric and his anger over a move by OPEC Plus to limit output at a time of energy difficulties for the U.S. and Europe had given further hope, even though the Turkish denunciations had already died down years ago.
Fraught as it is with behind-the-scenes jockeying, betrayals, and other moral failures, world politics took away not just one woman's hope for justice, but the entire world's faith in the willingness of the U.S. and other governments to stand up to tyranny despite all the rhetoric to the opposite effect. In killing Cengiz's hope for justice and perhaps closure, the U.S. and others had one message for all murderous dictators in the world. You're safe in America. That's about it for this episode. Thanks. We'll see you next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The war in Ukraine has created huge political, economic, and security losses for Europe, and the energy crisis caused by the Russian oil and gas embargo can be considered the most immediate and main impact of the war in Ukraine on Europe's economy. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Britain's Financial Times newspaper has covered this story and tells us more. Economists warn the lingering energy crisis is expected to cause further recession in the Eurozone this year. According to the latest report, prices in the region will rise by an average of over 6%, while the unemployment rate will increase from the current 6.5% to 7.1% by the end of 2023. High inflation and energy shortages will lead to a further decline in production and worsen the situation in the labour market. Subsequently, by the end of the year, the Eurozone economy will shrink by 0.01%. The energy crisis in the European Union worsened over the summer when sanctions and technical setbacks led to the first interruptions in gas supplies from Russia. While most economists have said that Europe is past the worst of the energy crisis this year, many worry that the prospect of energy rationing would return next heating season, especially if the upcoming months are cold and cause increased tapping of gas reserves. Economists are also worried about the outcome of further steps to stem inflation by the European Central Bank, the ECB. Marcello Missori, an economics professor at Lewis University in Rome, Italy, warned that further interest rate hikes could lead to a severe recession in the euro area. Agence France-Presse has also covered the same story and tells us more. Official figures showed recently inflation in Sweden surged to its highest point in the past 3 decades in December, fueled by soaring electricity prices that have hit the cost of living. Statistics Sweden said the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, accelerated to 12.3%, up from 11.5% in November, the highest figure since February of 1991. The main driver was the price of electricity, which rose 28.8% in December compared to the month before, and 45.3% compared to a year earlier. Sweden's inflation rate adjusted for fixed interest rates, the figure used by Sweden's central bank to guide monetary policy, jumped to 10.2% on an annual basis, up from 9.5% in November. In a bid to counter soaring inflation, the Scandinavian country's central bank has sharply hiked its key interest rate in recent months, from 0 in April to 2.5% currently, with its next monetary policy meeting scheduled for early February. The bank has signalled that more increases are underway. Inflation has soared worldwide in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, which started in February of 2022, prompting central banks to hike interest rates. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to official data released recently, Hungary's annual inflation rate spiked to 24.5% in December, the highest level since March of 1996. The Hungarian Central Statistical Office said electricity, gas and other fuels, along with food prices, were the main drivers of high inflation in Hungary. Electricity, gas and other fuels were 55.5% more expensive in December. Food prices jumped 44.8% on an annual basis, consumer durables jumped 13.6%, and service charges were up 9.5%. The authority said consumer prices increased by 1.9% on average in 1 month and by 14.5% on average in 2022, compared to the previous year. China's Xinhua news agency has also covered the same story. Portugal's National Institute of Statistics announced the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, registered an average annual variation of 7.8% in 2022 in the country, the highest since 1992. Last year, the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, rose 6.5 percentage points compared to 2021, when it was 1.3%. Rising energy and food prices were the main elements contributing to the increase in the Consumer Price Index, the CPI. Portuguese inflation rose more intensely in the first half of last year, while prices slowed down in the last 2 months of 2022. According to China's Xinhua news agency, Statistics Netherlands said on Tuesday, 10th of January, the annual inflation rate in the Netherlands was 10% in 2022, the highest since 1975, when the rate was 10.2% as a result of the oil crisis. Last year, the price development of energy, such as electricity, gas and district heating, in particular contributed to the high rate. The energy was on average 114% more expensive in 2022 than in 2021. The inflation rate was 2.7% in 2021. Food and motor fuels also had an impact on inflation. Food was 10.8% more expensive than 12 months previously. In 2021, food prices were still 0.2% lower. The rise in food prices was mainly caused by meat, dairy products, bread and grains and vegetables. In 2022, motor fuels were 18.1% more expensive than the year before, while in 2021, the increase was 16.8%. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, said on Tuesday, 10th of January, Greece's economic growth is likely to show just 1.1% this year from a 5.1% clip in 2022, as soaring energy costs and continued uncertainty about the war in Ukraine hurt spending and investments. Since the lifting of COVID restrictions, the Greek economy has recovered strongly thanks to the robust tourism revenues and improving consumer spending and investments. However, surging energy costs, supply disruptions, and uncertainty, mainly because of the war in Ukraine, are sharply slowing down the recovery in Greece. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, said, "The war is directly affecting Greece's energy supply and costs. It indirectly affects our compressing spending and delaying investment and hiring. Inflation, driven by rising energy prices, hit a 30-year high of 12% last summer in Greece and is eating away at Greek households' income." Britain's Guardian newspaper has also covered the same story. The Italian government statistics office reported recently prices in Italy rose 8.1% year-on-year in 2022, with surging energy prices contributing the most to what was the largest full-year increase since the mid-1980s. The full-year rate was the highest recorded in Italy since a 9.2% annual increase in 1985, when Italy still used the lira currency. In December, prices were 11.6% higher than in the same month in 2021 and down from 11.8% in November. It was still the third highest one-month rate recorded since the introduction of the euro currency in 1999. According to the National Institute of Statistics, the seven highest monthly inflation rates recorded in Italy since 1999 have all been in the last 7 months. High energy prices have been responsible for the bulk of these increases, pushed higher by the energy supply challenges caused by the conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at stories through an Islamic lens. Each week, we'll take a look at trending news, and this week we're looking at historical stories which have a direct relevance to the religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. Today, we're going to celebrate one of the golden ages of Islamic history, the 800-year period the Muslims ruled over what is modern-day Spain and Portugal. The anniversary of the end of that glorious period falls in the month of January, which is a great opportunity for Muslims to reflect on what made Muslim Spain, or Al-Andalus, so great.
In January 1492, the last Muslim kingdom of Al-Andalus, better known as Muslim Spain, fell to the Catholic monarchs, putting an end to 800 years of glorious Islamic civilization. The Muslim presence in the Iberian Peninsula was a time when religious tolerance, sophisticated scholarship, glorious architecture,